When we were kids, our parents shouted, "Get out of the sun!" And we obeyed. Finding shade is an Australian instinct. Our shops have awnings and our houses have verandas, or used to. We have folk songs celebrating the patchy shade of coolabah trees. We take umbrellas to the beach. But even so, here and around the world, shade is becoming a mark of privilege as town planners and developers turn against shadows, even as heat waves become the planet's deadliest natural disasters. In the face of all this, the environmental journalist Sam Block has written Shade, the promise of a forgotten natural resource. Sam joins me now from New York. Sam, welcome to Late Night Live.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sam, this story starts for you at a bus stop in Los Angeles.
That's right. I live in New York now, but I used to live in Los Angeles, and I think the first time I saw shade for what it really was at a bus stop. Now, I was one of the many millions of Angelenos who was able to afford to drive to work, and as I bumbled down from my hillside neighborhood and scooted through groves of eucalyptus and oak and walnut trees that had been planted 100 years earlier, my journey took me down a barren, tree-bereft street that culminated, let's say, at a traffic light in front of a bus stop, where I noticed passengers queuing up and waiting for their ride, just standing behind telephone poles and behind stop signs, trying to contrive whatever meager shelter they could from the sun in a city that evidently hadn't made any such affordances for the, as I later discovered, 700,000 or so people who get on a bus every day in Los Angeles. And that didn't seem right to me, and it didn't seem fair, because Los Angeles is a warming city. It's a city where the people who ride the bus tend to be the poorest and most vulnerable to the effects of heat. And I just didn't understand why it was so difficult just to put a roof over the heads of these people who so badly needed some shade.
You now live in New York City. Tell us about the modern politics of shade as it's playing out there.
Yeah. New York and Los Angeles are two very different cities, right? And New York is important in the story of shade because this is where zoning was created. Zoning is a legal tool that urban planners use to control the form of their commercial and their residential and even their industrial districts. And when zoning was invented and then codified in the early 20th century, this was a time when it was believed that daytime darkness and shadows were actually bad for public health. It was believed that tuberculosis thrived in daytime darkness and in shadows. It was believed that dark, airless, stuffy tenement districts, which were packed with immigrants, these were breeding grounds for not just, you know, physical diseases, but also moral diseases and abjection, like crime and depression. And urban planners worked very hard in New York to institute new rules to control the form of buildings, principally to admit more sunlight. You know, New York is famous for these Art Deco era buildings that are sort of tiered and stepped back like wedding cakes. And that's all designed to let more sun strike the lower floors of the buildings across the street. New York is also where height limits were sort of codified on buildings, right? You could only make them so tall based on the width of the street, and that was, again, to minimize the size of the shadow. And these rules, these height limits, these setbacks, these stepbacks, these all became foundational for rules that were adopted all over America and have basically been untouched since then. So, you know, today, shadow avoidance is pretty much just a basic tenet of American urban design. But some cities, New York included, have even gone farther beyond just this sort of baked-in shadow avoidance. There are all sorts of crazy political and social stigma and rules associated with shadow creation. People believe, again, that it's bad for their health. They believe that it creates crime. But what I write about in my book is that it's also an index of inequality, that if you look at a typical American city, the places that have the most leafy trees and luscious greenery tend to be the richer ones, and they tend to be the white Caucasian neighborhoods. So, you know, this may seem trivial, but as temperatures continue to rise and as heat waves become more extreme, having access to shade and having access to tree cover is going to be very important and even determinative in I would say, surviving on a warmer planet.
But Sam, isn't the question here really that you need shade when you need shade? But in winter, for instance, particularly I would have thought in New York, but it's the same is true in Melbourne or Sydney, in winter you want to get some sun into your house.
Yeah, fair enough. But I also think that culturally Americans, for the most part, now I'm sort of generalizing here, but let's just stick to New York for a second, are sort of, you know, conditioned to really think of the winter as being the big threat to their health. It's seldom appreciated that heat is already America's number one weather-related killer. More people die from high temperatures in America than they die from hurricanes, floods, tornadoes, and wildfires. You know, the cold, I think, is something that we all sort of feel innately, but heat, it doesn't strike us the same way, right? Nothing is freezing over or maybe literally catching on fire in a hot day. So we don't think of it as this danger. Yes, of course, in the middle of winter, the idea that we should be erecting huge skyscrapers to steal our sunlight is probably laughable and anathema to a lot of people. But there's so many other solutions I talk about in my book. I mean, trees are just one of them. There are awnings, there are canopies. You mentioned verandas, which I think are a beautiful tradition in Australia. There's so many other ways to make shade. We just have to loosen our regulations and to sort of and decide that it's something important for everyone.
You realize how brave you're being here, don't you? Because you're challenging one of the oldest maxims that sunlight is the best disinfectant. Sam Block is saying, no, we need shadow.
Well, what's the expression, right? Only mad dogs and Englishmen are know to go out in the midday sun or something like that.
We can have a war of cliches here. Yes, you're right. You look at ancient cities and you look at the way they absolutely valued shade. Now, they were cities built in the hottest places on Earth, weren't they? The formative cities of our civilization.
Yeah. One city that I talk about in my book, and I love this example, is the Mesopotamian city of Ur, located in the Fertile Crescent in modern-day Iraq. This is one of the cradles of human civilization. And according to an archaeologist who I spoke to, thousands of years ago, this city and many others like it were very likely designed specifically to minimize exposure to the sun. You know, the houses back then were only about 10 feet tall, but they were packed really close together. So you would traverse this network of really narrow canyon-like alleys that were pretty much plunged in the shade of other buildings. And between the narrowness of the streets, the diagonal orientation of the grid, and even other protrusions like vertical rooftop parapets and horizontal eaves, it's very likely that these ancient Mesopotamian cities offered this shadow network that was so much more comfortable than this brutal blazing plain beyond the city walls. I mean, it was explained to me that according to Sumerian mythology, one of the reasons that gods even commanded humans to build cities at all, the whole reason this sort of settlement form exists, is to create shade for the gods to refresh themselves in. I mean, this was such a different time. You know, shade was pretty much the only way to stay cool. And, you know, in this blazing hot summer that could probably reach like 50 degrees Celsius, having shade wasn't just physically important. It took on this larger than life quality. It became supernatural or cultic. I mean, I mentioned this Sumerian myth about creating shade, but there are all these superstitions about shady houses and cool houses being luckier than sunnier ones.
And then later on, the Greeks built cities that had shade. The Romans built cities that shade was a kind of an imperial gift to the cities.
Yeah, that's right. So the Greeks valued shade for a different reason. I mean, the Mediterranean is a hot place, but it couldn't be quite as brutal as the Middle East. You know, this was the ancient Greeks wanted to conduct their affairs not behind closed doors, but in public and in full view of one another. So they would meet in stoas, which were these monumental stone colonnades that surrounded the agora or the town square. And in these covered open halls, this is where you had the convening of the popular assembly, the hearings of the magistrates, the displays of laws and arts, social gatherings, popular education. I mean, the philosophers that we know today, like Socrates and Zeno, they would stroll in the shade of the Stoa, and that's where they would lecture for public audiences. And in fact, Aristotle, when he started his philosophical school of the Peripatetics, that was actually taken from the Greek word peripatoi, meaning shady walks. So this Greek culture and this way of life, this sort of aspiration of democracy and of public representation, this was all found in the shade of the Stoa.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Sam Block about shade. Sam, those ancient cities didn't seem to provide shade by planting trees. That seems to have been something that cities just didn't do. Yes, arcades. Yes, great buildings where people could shelter, but not planting trees. Why not?
Well, let's think about all the problems that trees might cause in cities, right? You plant a big one in the road and these roots can tear, you know, in today's world into plumbing or buckle, wrap around a sewer line. But, you know, hundreds of years ago, these roots would probably lift the pavement and sort of get in the way of things. It was believed that tree branches caused fires and were fueling these conflagrations. Trees were this icon of rurality. Trees were an icon of the forest, which a lot of Europeans were very afraid of. I mean, the word savage comes from the Latin word silva for tree. This whole idea that the forest was a place where you had Robin Hood-like robbers, where you had dangerous things happening, those were all things that belonged outside the city walls, belonged in nature. You know, the city was stone and civilization. So this idea that trees would come into play and create the necessary shade that people needed for cooling didn't really take effect until, you know, at least in America, the 17th and 18th century, and really the 19th century, after things like fire insurance came along, after sort of modern progress basically, shorn trees of their stigma, let's say.
And after the miasma theory. Tell us about the miasma theory.
Right. So in the 18th century, American cities were contending with disaster in the form of yellow fever, this really intense disease that was decimating American cities. I think a really bad yellow fever attack, let's say, I think killed 10% of people who lived in Philadelphia, which at the time was America's capital. And there was this anxiety and worry about, you know, what is going to happen if we have all these people dying from yellow fever in the summer, and you have leading minds and physicians starting to think, well, you know, part of the reason why we have this disease is because of miasmas, which are basically bad airs or vapors. And their belief was that these bad airs are being released from the ground when it was being heated and exposed to sun. So in my book, I talk about different theories about different ways to shade city streets to make sure that they wouldn't get struck with sun and release these bad airs. You know, Noah Webster, who Americans know as the guy in the dictionary, he thought that Middle Eastern design of making narrow roads might actually make a lot of sense in that way. Another physician thought that maybe it was best to build like the Spaniards did with a minimum of windows. Again, the sort of idea of a shady and a cool house. But they all decided that wasn't really right for America, and they didn't want to act like these other, you know, foreign cultures, and that trees, nature's coolers, would be the ones that could help them shade city streets. So in addition to cooling the surfaces and preventing them from getting heated by the sun, they also believed that trees had this other power, that their foliage could absorb the noxious gases and kind of clean and purify the air and get rid of whatever was causing yellow fever. Now, we know that's not true. We know now that yellow fever is spread by mosquitoes, but they were onto something. Trees do purify the air and they do absorb gases, just not the ones they were thinking of.
And that's kind of modern thinking today, isn't it, about the role of trees in cities? But before we go there, let's go back right to the beginning, because you also argue that shade is an essential quality of really the evolution of life.
So I was surprised to learn when I was researching this book that 99% of animal species of life on planet Earth can be classified as ectothermic, meaning animals that don't really have metabolisms. They can't really control the way that they create heat or dispel heat, that their bodies are very closely tied to the environments that they're in. And so I talk about Chinook salmon in the Pacific Northwest, for example. You know, these are animals that like their water really cold. And when it comes time for them to spawn in the summer and in the fall, after they make their way upstream and they look for a place to, you know, lay their eggs and create more life, they have to do it somewhere cool. So, you know, their bodies would overheat really quickly if they were in the sun. So they're just naturally drawn to the shade as a place to do that. There are lots of animal species that need shade for this sort of thermoregulation is what scientists call it, right? The controlling of body temperature. You know, humans, we are blessed with this amazing ability to sweat. That's mostly how we control heat in our bodies. But some scientists that I talk to think that just on the largest, longest scale of organic animal evolution, let's say, that the idea to sweat and the other forms of sort of internal body thermoregulation really only appeared very recently. That for most of animal life on planet Earth, it has really been about finding shade. And these newer things, these things that we think make us human, are really very new. So, you know, when we sweat, that makes us human. But when we run into the shade to cool down, that's what makes us just another animal.
So we should think of ourselves not as products of the grasslands, but of the forest.
Well, we'll never really know. The savanna hypothesis, you know, this idea that we became humans out under the sun, out on the African plain. That's where we became bipedal. That's where we sort of learned to stand upright. You know, in the past 20 or 30 years or so, archaeologists and anthropologists have uncovered some evidence that might suggest that humans actually learned to walk when they were in the forests, that in the trees is actually where we discovered our humanity.
Let's roll forward a few billion years to the discovery in the early 1900s by a man called Carrier of a way of cooling air and how that has transformed our relationship to shade.
Right. Let's go to one of the first years of the 20th century in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. There's a magazine printing plant that is trying to issue like the new issue of this humor magazine, but it's a really sticky, humid New York summer. And all the pages are getting stuck together and the registrations are getting destroyed. And someone from the heating company comes in, this guy Willis Carrier, who's trying to figure out a way to remove the humidity from the printing plant and to dry the air. And he has this idea of basically piping in chilled, cool air inside the factory floor and in the process removing the hot air and expelling it back outside. Again, this is all just to control the humidity. But the byproduct becomes the cooling, and that really becomes the thing that makes air conditioning this magnificent invention that spreads not just from the floors of this printing plant, but then to textile mills. It spreads to other factories. It spreads to banks. It spreads to offices. It spreads to the halls of government where people can start working on and legislating all year round. It spreads to movie theaters. You know, Americans start sitting through this summer dreck just to stay cool.
Yes.
And then eventually air conditioning comes home. And, you know, in my book, I talk about how when air conditioning comes home, this is really the beginning of the end for a lot of the sort of historical shade strategies and sort of shady architecture that Americans and people all around the world used to rely on to stay cool. Because once you have this machine that you can kind of just pop into like a port in your home, you know, as a developer and as a builder, you're passing on the cost of cooling to the occupant. And to be clear, air conditioning is so much more powerful than shade. I mean, shade helps you tolerate your environment. Shade helps you stay cool. Air conditioning obliterates heat. It completely smashes it. So it's understandable that most people would want this machine that works so much better than an awning or a sleeping porch or an overhanging eave. But at the same time, I don't think people understood back then the amount of energy that it would cost or the amount of energy that would be consumed to cool so many homes, the way it would transform architecture, the way it would transform our cities. And as I argue, the way it would transform the planet, with the huge amount of greenhouse gases associated with the machine itself, and then the energy that's consumed to power these cooling machines, are a significant contributor to global warming. And today, we're sort of stuck in this trap where we have to stay cool inside at the expense of ever more hellish conditions outside.
You've got an amazing statistic in the book that 88% of households in the United States have air conditioning. That's just a staggering number. Nearly everyone.
Yeah, and I do want to defend, let's say, the widespread adoption of air conditioning in the United States just for a bit, because, you know, the United States has different climates. Where I live in New York, I don't really use air conditioning for most of the year, but, you know, people who live in the Southeast United States, where it's very hot and humid throughout the year, people who live in the very dry, arid Southwest, you know, you have high temperatures pretty much all year. And before air conditioning, these were much sleepier, more desolate areas where you didn't have a lot of people living because it was just a lot harder to make it. Air conditioning is really what enables the way of life in a lot of these southern cities. So that high uptake, that high rate of air conditioning in the United States is basically the sign of us conquering innate climate through machine technology.
Yes, it's not in Australia, the uptake is not nearly as big. Oh, look, before I talk about Australia, Sam, tell us how wonderful we are.
Well, Australians, my understanding is that you have had it drummed into your head for decades now that sun avoidance is an important cultural practice. In fact, Australians have a jingle and a catchy mnemonic, slip, slop, slap, that is foreign to Americans, but which I understand every Australian of a certain age can sing easily. You know, in America, our most popular mnemonic is about escaping homes during fires, which is a very rare event for most people. We don't have this sort of daily awareness of having to get out of the sun the way that Australians do.
And slip, slop, slap, the stuff we're slip, slop, slapping on us, is a kind of shade that you get out of a tube.
Well, hang on, I quibble with this a little bit, because the shade in a tube that you get from sunscreen, that protects your skin from UV radiation. And UV radiation is dangerous and it causes skin cancer, but it doesn't protect your skin from the infrared rays in the sun, which is where most of the heat is. So when you slather sunscreen on your skin, the only heat protection that it really offers you is in the white coloring, because that is sort of solar reflective. It's a kind of shade, but it doesn't protect you from heat the same way a proper awning or a canopy does.
But it has to be remembered that my predecessor in this job, Philip Adams, was the guy who in his advertising days invented that jingle. Pretty extraordinary. Now, Sam, we've only got a few moments left. What are the cities that are doing best in the world at the moment in dealing with approaching warming and the dangers of heat waves?
Well, I don't think any city is really doing a good enough job, because we know pretty much, it's pretty much settled scientifically that if cities decided to fill the streets and roads and parks and cram trees into every nook and cranny of public space, it is possible to lower the air temperature of cities, and that's just not happening. So it's within reach to basically shade out a lot of the effects of climate change. Now, that said, there are cities that are doing things that are replicable and scalable. In the book, I went to Western Europe and I went to Barcelona in Spain, and what they've been doing there is reclaiming space from cars and giving it back to pedestrians and to bikers and to trees. So they're closing streets and they're depaving asphalt, and they're putting in tree pits and tree wells where there used to be cars stored, let's say. And that's super important, because the more asphalt that you remove from a city and the more vegetation and shading that you put in, that lowers the temperature, so that mitigates climate change. And then by doing that, you're also adapting to climate change. So it's both, you know, addressing the cause of the warming and also doing something about living with it. So that's a really good approach. And that's being emulated now in cities in the United States as well.
And it looks beautiful.
Who wouldn't love to walk down a tree under kissing canopies of arching London planes and jacarandas? It's gorgeous.
Sam, thank you. Sam Block has written this splendid book, Shade, The Promise of a Forgotten Natural Resource. And Sam, one of the pleasures of your book are the photographs of people instinctively gathering in shade. They're kind of, they're hilarious as well as heartwarming. Is that why you chose them?
Well, I chose those photos because I think shade gets a bad rap. I mean, we talked about this at the beginning. You asserted that everyone wants sun, and I'm this lone shade maniac, Don Quixote, trying to say that that shadows are the important thing. But these photographs I included in the book of people sort of unconsciously being drawn to shadows just demonstrates the innate need and the innate magnetism of shade. It's something that we all crave, even if we don't know that we're craving it. It's been forgotten, but I think our body sort of knows it.
Look for the cover, ladies and gentlemen, where you'll see a little knot of people sitting on a grassy bank in the shade that is cast by a palm tree. Sam, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.